woman began with a smile, saying he decided to speak because the people wanted a little common sense.
It is easy for them to construe the oath which you took as members of the legislature. They didn't take that oath. You took it.
Color drained from the faces of suffrage women in the galleries. The man who was a charter member of the Men's Ratification Committee, who had repeatedly assured Mrs. Catt and all the Tennessee suffs of his support for ratification, was suddenly changing his tune.
I'm in favor of giving the women the ballot, Stallman maintained in what had become a familiar anti-refrain. But I'm not in favor of giving them this power through any doubtful action by the Tennessee legislature.
Suffs in the galleries held back tears. They were being betrayed again.
We fought for democracy in Europe, but now we are apparently attempting to take it away from ourselves at home.
Stallman fumed in a rant against the federal amendment centralization of power.
The most sensible expression I heard this evening was from Senator Harding, Stallman said,
lauding Harding's good faith, good taste, and justice, while giving the Democrats in the room a shiver.
I hope Governor Cox will do the same thing Senator Harding did. The truth is, neither one had any business meddling in our affairs.
Stallman's comments went on for only 10 minutes, but it seemed an eternity to the suffs in the chamber. Stallman was, without doubt, a powerful man in Nashville, and the editorial pages of his banner were influential. Now both were arrayed against them. It was nearing midnight when, the debate concluded, members of the Senate and House Constitutional Committees withdrew into executive session to deliberate upon ratification. The potential damage of Harding's letter and the infuriating betrayal of Stallman riled the pro-ratification members of the Senate committee and spurred Senator Gwin to move quickly. After some sparring, Gwin emerged from the meeting to announce that the committee would return a favorable report, recommending ratification of the federal amendment in the morning. Senate Speaker Todd said the Senate would vote on ratification within an hour of receiving the committee's recommendation. Things did not go as smoothly in the House committee session, to the suffs' distress. Seth Walker, as Speaker, was an ex officio member of every House committee, and while he rarely availed himself of this privilege, he took good advantage of it now to attend the committee's deliberations. His presence rattled Tom Riddick, the rookie committee chairman, and Walker was able to easily outmaneuver him. Walker leveraged his personal friendships and Speaker's muscle to force the committee to postpone consideration of the ratification resolution, delaying any vote until the following week at the earliest. The committee had the right to hold the resolution for up to 7 days, and there was some possibility it would. The ratificationists on the committee were furious with Walker's interference and with Riddick's inability to counter it. When they emerged from the conference, frustrated and tired, they rushed into a series of additional strategy sessions that ran far into the night. Throughout the debate, and even while the committee deliberations were grinding on into the new day, Governor Roberts retained his posture of confidence. Senate ratification of the 19th Amendment was assured, he said, unless something miraculous occurs. It was a strange way to put it. Chapter 19. Petticoat Government. The possibility of supernatural intervention was also on the minds of the antis. It was, after all, Friday the 13th. The day will be a hoodoo for ratification, several antis promised reporters, elevating superstition to political analysis. The suffs managed a condescending smile and assured their opposition that old-time beliefs, both as to woman suffrage and Friday the 13th, are going to meet their Waterloo. It was hard to tell what the fallout might be from Harding's bungling. Harriet Upton was speechless with rage. Republican Chairman Will Hayes was being pummeled by complaints. How could Harding do this? He was inviting Tennessee legislators to kill the amendment, He was undermining the Republican record on women's suffrage. Hayes was furious with Harding. Democratic vice presidential candidate Franklin Roosevelt, on the stump in the Midwest, took gleeful potshots at Harding's comic gyrations of opinion on Tennessee ratification and his flip-flopping on support for woman suffrage over the years. The GOP candidate's position on woman suffrage, FDR said with a broad grin, was as clear as mud. Neither Carrie Catt nor Alice Paul made any public comments on Harding's letter to Judge Tillman, though they fumed in private. They thought it best not to bring more attention to the unfortunate reasoning of the man from Marion. Just let it die. But based upon the many newspapers, in Tennessee and across the country, that reprinted Harding's letter in their pages, it was not going to die. The suffragists needed 17 senators to vote their way today, and another 50 votes in the House. Whenever the ratification resolution managed to escape the clutches of Seth Walker within the Constitutional Amendments Committee and make it to the floor. No one could predict when that might be. There was talk that Walker and his friends were trying to arrange for the resolution to be buried in the committee, never to emerge. Tom Riddick's failure to protect the resolution in that committee the previous night was the last straw for the pro-ratification House Democrats. Riddick might be a brilliant lawyer, but he was just too green a legislator, and his leadership, or lack thereof, was endangering the amendment, they contended. He didn't know how to work the system. No member owed him any favors or loyalty, and he had been elected only to serve in the special session. Riddick's somewhat arrogant, abrasive style rubbed many of the old-timers the wrong way, and the rural fellows found million-dollar Riddick, the lawyer with a very lucrative practice, too rich for their blood. Early Friday morning, the House Democrats staged a mutiny, insisting on a new floor leader. They found a suitable replacement, Joe Hanover. He was experienced, well-liked, politically savvy, and devoted to suffrage. Carrie Catt heartily approved, as she had confidence that Hanover was well-equipped to execute the Suff's ratification strategy. By breakfast time on Friday, Hanover was the new House ratification floor leader. "Have pity on good old Joe," his friends moaned. "Everyone knows the stiffest battle is going to be in the House." But the Senate had to be won first. Exhausted and demoralized, the Woman's Party staff in Tennessee had been looking forward to having their own commander provide leadership, rather than Mrs. Catt. But Alice Paul was still in D.C., a victim of bad cash flow. But as much as Sue White yearned for Miss Paul to march into Nashville and relieve her of the awful responsibility of directing the party's role in this definitive fight, she also knew, deep down, that it might be best that Miss Paul stay away. A harsh sentiment had arisen among many of the legislators against all outsiders, the Woman's Party in particular. The Betty Graham incident didn't help. Both the Antis and the Tennessee Suffs were still angry about Graham's scene with Seth Walker. Miss Paul wouldn't care a fig about all that. She'd stared down tougher opponents and had no desire to do the polite thing rather than the right thing. But her presence in the city would be a distraction. More than a distraction, a gift to the Antis. They were already having a field day with Mrs. Catt. Imagine what diabolical fun they could have with Miss Paul. Sue White willed herself to be calm and brave and focused. She wasn't a little orphan anymore, feeling abandoned, having to make her own way. She was a confident, competent woman, and she knew what to do. Accent the positive. This proved Miss Paul's deep trust in her leadership abilities. She'd have to live up to that trust. She pinned a nosegay of purple, white, and gold asters to her open collar. Those were the new special Woman's Party floral badges. And straightened her prison pin. Miss Paul wasn't coming to Nashville, and Miss Sue must lead the troops. Josephine Pearson also willed herself to remain calm and collected. It wasn't easy for her. She was easily provoked. Her temper, when triggered by what she considered a moral outrage, expressed itself in emotional outbursts that could be embarrassing. "If I can get Josephine Pearson mad, we will win," Kate Warner boasted to another suffragist in the hallway of the Hermitage. Warner had witnessed a few of these episodes over the years. Pearson heard the boast and refused to give Warner such satisfaction. Whenever events in Nashville disturbed her, Pearson would lock herself in her seventh-room floor for a spell, until the bubbling anger subsided, and she regained her composure. Then President General Pearson would return to duty. On Friday morning, a throng of suffs and antis, in full floral regalia, pushed through the doors of the Senate gallery, scrambling and shouldering one another to grab a good seat. In an impressive display of political symbolism, the pro-ratification senators had invited prominent Tennessee suffrage women to sit beside them at their desks as guests, but also as future partners in the governing process. They were in for quite a show. Andrew Todd gaveled the Senate to order, and Estes Gwynn delivered the majority report of the Constitutional Amendments Committee. The report, hammered out in the early morning hours, was remarkably strong and unequivocal, even embellished by some rhetorical flourishes. "The committee is of the opinion that the present legislature has both a legal and moral right to ratify the proposed resolution," the report said, detailing the legal rationales for this judgment. "Its adoption is as certain as the recurrence of the seasons. National woman suffrage by federal amendment is at hand," the senators wrote. "It may be delayed, but it cannot be defeated, and we covet for Tennessee the signal honor of being the 36th and last state necessary to consummate this great reform." Cheers from suffs in the balcony rang out as Senator Gwynn finished the report. "Fully persuaded of its justice and confident of its passage, we earnestly recommend the adoption of the resolution." More clapping. But there was a minority report, too, written by the two members of the committee who disagreed, insisting that the Senate must refuse to act upon ratification. After sparring and the first test vote, the minority report was tabled by a comfortable margin, and the majority report was accepted by a voice vote. More suff hurrahs. Ernest Haston, the suff's floor leader in the Senate, rose to place the ratification resolution itself before the Senate for passage, but Lon McFarland jumped to his feet. "Point of order," he yelled, and handed a written protest to the clerk, contending that the Senate had no power or authority to act on the ratification resolution. Speaker Todd overruled the point of order, and McFarland appealed the speaker's decision, but Todd's rule was sustained by an overwhelming majority. These were the warm-up acts to the day's drama, and there was a rustle of movement, both on the floor and above, as the chamber braced for the main attraction. Senator Herschel Candler took the floor. Candler was a man of the law, a husband and father, a former colonel in the army, but he felt like a lonely warrior, abandoned by his own Senate colleagues and his party. They were all trying to defeat him in his crusade to prevent this abomination of woman's suffrage from infecting the entire nation. He glanced around the chamber to see many of his colleagues sitting with women lobbyists at their elbows, sharing their desks, whispering in their ears. Coarse political women, who should be at home, but instead they were invading the Senate sanctum. A few of his fellow senators had political bosses sitting beside them, keeping them on a leash, making sure they voted the way they were told. It sickened him. He considered himself a man of patience and probity, but damn it, he was not going down without a fight.
"I know of the pressure that has been exerted here," Candler told his colleagues, "and I am humiliated to confess that Southern Republicans are Republicans for revenue only."
A segment of the men in the chamber grumbled.
"I know of men who a week ago were against this thing, are for it today, and I know why. Many of them now have their names on the state payroll," Candler continued, eliciting angry glares from the floor. I am here representing the mothers who are at home rocking the cradle, and not representing the low neck and high skirt variety, Candler said, pointing his finger at a group of suffragists, who know not what it is to go down in the shade of the valley and bring forth children. Motherhood has no appeal to them.
Women began to hiss at Candler, and an incensed suff in the gallery shouted down, I have 6 children! He didn't give up. The federal amendment was the dawn of petticoat politics, Candler maintained, an era of radical feminine domination.
If there is anything I despise, it is a man who is under petticoat government, he blasted.
Men joined in the hissing.
You are being dictated to by an old woman down here at the Hermitage Hotel whose name is Cat. I think her husband's name is Tom,
Candler joked lamely.
Mrs. Cat is nothing more than an anarchist.
The hissing grew louder, almost drowning out Candler's screed.
Have you read the speech of hers before an audience in New York, when she said that she would be glad to see the day when Negro men could marry white women, and it is none of society's concern? This is the kind of woman that is trying to dictate to us.
Even some of his fellow senators were hissing Candler now.
They would drag the womanhood of Tennessee down to the level of the Negro woman.
Protests rained down on him from every corner of the chamber. He was undeterred. He steadied himself to make his final, terrifying point.
Within a very few years after this amendment has passed, you will find that Congress has legislated so as to compel we people of the South to give to the Negro men and women their full rights at the ballot box,
he warned in a shrill voice.
Then you will find many of your counties, now dominated by the Democrats and white people, sending up Negro representatives to this House. I've telegraphed to Senator Harding my unwillingness to violate the Constitution of my state. I warn the majority in this chamber now that the next thing we know, Negroes will be here legislating in Tennessee as they did 50 years ago.
The chamber broke into a hissing, shouting, and jeering frenzy. Flushed and spent, he sat down. His colleagues were embarrassed by Candler's outburst. The Tennessee suffs were outraged, and even the antis found his statements offensive. And worse, possibly damaging to their efforts. Candler had managed to insult everyone. Andrew Todd left the speaker's chair to respond. He tried to calm the room, speaking in a stern but soothing, fatherly tone.
That is the most unfortunate speech that has ever been made upon the floor of the Senate, he lamented. These slurs do not meet approval of the good women of Tennessee, he chastised Candler. I am convinced that there yet remains enough virtue among the womanhood of Tennessee and enough courage among the manhood of the state to see that no condition such as the senator from McMinn has pictured would ever occur, Todd said in rebuttal. We won't have Negro rule. Republicans and Democrats alike would take their muskets and go to the polls to prevent it.
Todd was, unfortunately, correct about that.
There are no sinister influences here, Todd said, trying to inject some humor into the tense proceedings. Talk about petticoat government.
If there is a man in this house or in the gallery who has not been under petticoat government ever since he was born, I want him to stand up. I am ready to go into petticoat government.
The Suffs clapped their hands sore for Todd.
I have always been under that kind, and I thank God for it.
Todd received an ovation as he returned to the speaker's chair. Governor Roberts now entered the chamber, and all eyes followed him as he made his way to the speaker's desk, sitting down next to Senator Todd. His silent presence gave the signal that he was keeping score. The Suffs applauded his appearance, the Antis viewed him with suspicion, and they noticed Roberts's surrogate, Albert Williams, circulating among the senators aligned with the administration, reminding them of what they'd promised. Congressman Will Taylor kept an eye on his fellow Republicans while he sat at the desk of one senator known to be opposed to ratification, never leaving his side until the roll was called. The men of the Senate felt compelled to explain themselves, to justify their positions, and for almost 3 hours a steady parade of wordy senators took the floor. Most rehashed the legal arguments or made the case for party obligation to ratify— but almost every speaker condemned, or more painfully, ridiculed, Herschel Candler's vituperative remarks. Republican National Committee member John Houck, who'd had a bad night after Harding's letter was revealed at the debate, stood to make a ringing speech.
There is no politics in this proposition, and there is no nigger in this proposition, Houck declared. It is a proposition of right and justice.
Houck paused to accommodate the sustained applause from the gallery.
The time to split hairs is gone, he proclaimed. In all my life I have never heard a sound argument against giving woman the right to vote. A woman is a human being, and so is entitled to a vote in the making of laws affecting her and her children.
Speaker Todd rapped his gavel to quiet the loud cheering. Anita Politzer's favorite, Erastus Patton of Knoxville, also took after Candler.
I have never been a pie-hunting Republican, Patton protested,
taking umbrage at Candler's insinuation that his fellow party members could be influenced by patronage. And he took exception to Candler's allegations that woman suffrage would be ruinous to state government.
If I thought for 1 minute... it would work to the detriment of my little girl at home. I would vote against it,
Patton vowed.
But you can't tell me that these magnificent women are going to turn the government into anarchy.
Patton paused and then continued with a mischievous smile.
We have been accused of having petticoat government, but the senator is mistaken there. He's behind the times because they don't wear 'em anymore.
And the chamber broke into laughter. A few women blushed. Patton closed with a stirring appeal to the lawmakers to grant women their political freedom and a share in their government, ending with a rallying cry that brought all yellow-flowered spectators to their feet.
Let's make Tennessee the perfect 36th!
More senators stood to make heartfelt entreaties for ratification, including Senator C.C. Collins, who insisted on leaving his sickbed to attend the session and had to be helped to his seat, but who now rose shakily to his feet and, clinging to his desk, spoke up for ratification.
I'm voting for ratification because suffrage is right and just, not just because it aids either party,
declared Albert Hill, upon whom the Suffs knew they could rely.
I believe that with equal suffrage we will have a better country and better government.
But one senator was less motivated by idealism than revenge. William Monroe was an avowed anti. He'd opposed limited suffrage for Tennessee women the previous year and was listed as opposed to ratification, but he'd been bombarded with telegrams from anti-women in the North, specifically Connecticut, begging him not to impose woman suffrage upon their state by Tennessee's ratification. He didn't like Yankees telling him what to do.
Let's put back to Connecticut what she put on us,
Monroe taunted gleefully, referring to the way that state, as well as other northern states, had readily ratified the 14th and 15th Amendments giving freed slaves civil rights and black men the vote.
Connecticut was one of the first to take a position upon the question of Negro voting, Monroe explained. Now that Connecticut took great pride in giving the South these amendments, it stands her in poor grace to say that we cannot hand back the question of woman suffrage. But I, for one, take great pleasure in so doing.
It was still and always about the Civil War, but if sour revenge brought another senator into the I column for ratification, the Suffs were willing to clap for Monroe and his spiteful justification. Carrie Catt and Harriet Upton waited impatiently in the Hermitage for word from the Senate chamber. Catt kept busy with correspondence. She'd received a report from the private eye in New York, digging for information about that mystery man in the Hermitage lobby, the one who claimed to represent a newspaper syndicate, or the Republican Party, or some other fiction. He was a fake, the investigator reported. His card bore a phony name. His company did not exist. His sponsors were shady. Stay away from him, the gumshoe advised Cat. Make sure no one gives him any information. Cat wasn't surprised. She'd suspected the fellow was working for one of the corporate opponents of suffrage, one of the sinister influences. But this report just confirmed it. He wasn't the only such actor in the Hermitage lobby, she was certain. It seemed long ago, but it was just last February when Cat and Upton were so sure that they were on the verge of victory. So sure that at the National Association's final convention, after Cat made her valedictory speech launching the League of Women Voters, Upton had presented her with a beautiful victory brooch, a blue sapphire, the chief's favorite color, surrounded by little diamonds. It was a gift of gratitude from suffragists across the country, and even school children had contributed their nickels and dimes to honor Mrs. Catt. The brooch would complement her ratification dress so well, and on that evening everyone had expected ratification to be completed within days. Catt was immensely touched by the gift, but she refused to wear the brooch until ratification was actually won. Here they were, 6 months later, marooned in a stifling room in strife-torn Nashville, still waiting for ratification. Upton longed for nothing so much as to see that brooch on Mrs. Catt's bosom. There was also anxious waiting within the Woman's Party's townhouse in Washington, as Alice Paul and her staff awaited bulletins from their colleagues in Nashville. "We are waiting, as women have had to wait through all these ages, as patiently as possible for the results of the vote," Paul's secretary wrote that morning. "Our helplessness when we reach the final consummation of a piece of work, where we have to depend upon the judgment of men for the final word, is maddening, even though it is an age-long helplessness." It was well past lunchtime when the ratification resolution finally came to a vote in the Senate. The roll call moved swiftly. Bradley, aye. Burkhader, aye. Caldwell, aye. Candler, no. One senator walked out of the chamber to avoid voting. Lon McFarland and two other senators abstained. An electric tension vibrated through the chamber as the aye votes climbed towards 17, the majority threshold needed to ratify in the 33-member Senate. Hauk, aye, was number 14 on Sue White's tally sheet. Long, aye, was number 15 on Catherine Kenny's recording list. The antis tried to raise a small ruckus of disapproval as the ayes mounted, and several men they'd been counting on buckled, under the lash of the bosses, as they put it, and deserted them. McMahon, aye, was number 16, and the clamor in the galleries grew louder, with everyone wearing yellow up on their feet. Matthews, aye, and as the 17th vote in favor was cast, the gallery exploded in cheers and cries, waving of yellow banners and deafening applause. The tumultuous demonstration continued, forcing a temporary suspension of the roll call. Speaker Todd banged his gavel repeatedly, but the Suffs were still making so much noise that few people could hear the clerk continuing the roll or hear the senator's replies. The Suffs didn't care. They knew they'd won the Senate. When the clerk finally shouted in a hoarse bark, the final tally of 25 voting aye, 4 nay, 1 absent, and 3 not voting, the Suffs boomed again, and Todd had to call upon the sergeant-at-arms to subdue the rumpus. Cat and Upton could hear the cheers wafting up toward the hotel window. The vote was a surprise, with stronger support for ratification than either side had expected. Several senators, card indexed as anti, had suddenly switched sides to bolster the margin. As the senators exited the chamber, they encountered a line of smiling suffragists who saucily lifted their skirts just enough to reveal a bit of ruffle beneath, proving that they still wore petticoats. Streams of women and men, in distinct rivulets of yellow or red, cascaded down Capitol Hill from the State House toward the Hermitage. The Tennessee Suffs ran to Mrs. Catt's room to give her a full report. The vote was splendid, she agreed. The political leaders of both parties had done a fine job of keeping their men flying straight, and Republican senators hadn't taken Harding's free pass to abandon their pledges. But Cat was disturbed by Senator Candler's comments about her on the floor. She didn't care about him calling her an anarchist or a dictator, but she blanched when the Suffs related Candler's accusation that she favored intermarriage between the races. This could cause real trouble. In a southern state such as Tennessee, racial taboos held tremendous power. In 1920, interracial marriage was illegal in 30 of the 48 states, including Tennessee, and anti-miscegenation laws would remain enshrined in state constitutions for almost another half century, until declared unconstitutional by the U.S. Supreme Court. Even in those New England and upper Midwestern states where interracial marriage was not against the law, it was widely scorned. Cat was right that mixed-race marriage was a toxic topic, and woman suffrage could not afford to be in any way associated with it. She'd never said anything about marriage between the races. The allegation was a calculated lie, manufactured by the antis and mouthed by their man Candler. But it could still be dangerous. She could not allow it to stand. Within hours, she'd written a firm, terse response and released it to the press. "It is an absolute fabrication that I have at any time advocated intermarriage between the white and Negro races," she insisted. "Furthermore, I believe it to be an absolute crime against nature." Her statement was published in newspapers across the country. Once again, Cat distanced herself from the ideal of true equality in pursuit of the franchise. She'd taken a similar position earlier in the year, during the South Carolina ratification campaign, when she'd refuted rumors circulating in the state capitol that she'd been entertained in Negro homes and entertained Negroes in my home. "This is a most malicious appeal to sectional prejudice," Cat complained to a South Carolina senator. "I emphatically deny these stories." Whether her Aunt Susan, who proudly welcomed many black guests to stay in her home and cherished her special place in Frederick Douglass's household, would have approved of her protege's small-minded defense of the amendment that bore her name, can only be surmised. When pressed for the source of his allegations about Cat's views on interracial marriage, Candler had to admit he'd stretched things a bit, connected dots in a most haphazard way. He said he'd based his claim on a published interview with Cat, in which she was quoted as saying, "Suffrage knows no bias of race, color, or sex." Cat did believe that, at least in the abstract. Though both houses of the legislature were adjourned until Monday, and the House vote wasn't yet scheduled, the pace of activity in the Hotel Hermitage did not abate on Friday afternoon. The antis were not downcast by the Senate's action. The Senate vote was no indicator of suffrage's strength, Charlotte Rao told the press. This happened in other southern states, she said. It will be remembered that in both Mississippi and Delaware, the Senate ratified, but defeated the amendment in the House by 2-1. These two states were working under the same party pressure as Tennessee is now. The antis were setting their sights on the House, a more fertile field for their activities. They brandished copies of the Friday afternoon banner, which, as expected after Major Stallman's public denunciations the night before, had turned its editorial pages against ratification. While the antis held strategy meetings on the mezzanine level of the Hermitage, the Suffs held their own in the assembly rooms below, just off the lobby, and then broke into smaller conclaves throughout the hotel and state house. Joe Hanover took charge, projecting confidence and determination. Hanover ordered another canvass of the House members to solidify the pledges and identify any weak reeds among the members. Hanover was hearing things about legislators having second and third thoughts. The Tennessee Suffs were assigned to find their delegates once more. Finding those delegates was made decidedly more difficult, as many had packed their bags and headed home for the weekend. The legislators were tired and grumpy, and staying in Nashville cost more than their per diem salary could cover. For those who lived close enough to make a weekend sprint home feasible, it was a chance to unwind, see their family, and consult with constituents. This made the Suffs very nervous, to think of the House members moving beyond their grasp and into the grip of unknown persuaders. Suffragists in the home districts were put on alert to keep an eye on their Solons, while those in Nashville were ordered to stick close to the delegates who remained in the city. The suffrage women were each assigned two delegates and took their responsibilities seriously, inviting their designated men to lunch and to dinner, for a ride in the country, a game of cards or a moving picture show, anything to keep them out of the clutches of anti-workers, corporate lobbyists, or a bender in the Jack Daniels suite. The legislators certainly enjoyed the attention of some very attractive and socially prominent women, including Annie Laurie Stallman, an energetic suffragist who was seen hosting a delegate at the Tony Bell Mead Country Club, against the vehement protests of her father-in-law. The Suff's work was to cajole and coddle, entertain and amuse the delegates, as Harriet Upton described it, all the while making strong, logical arguments for ratification. Some newspapers took a more hyperbolic view of the suffragists' attentions. Automobile rides, hugs, kisses, even the absurdity of polishing the members' noses and rouging their cheeks in the assembly hall were frequently witnessed, one observer claimed. Warren Harding did not send any note of congratulations to the senators of Tennessee. He was baffled by the negative reaction to the letter he'd written to Judge Tillman about fidelity to conscience and honorable reluctance to violate one's oath of office. It proved he was a man of principle, he believed. He'd gladly given Tillman permission to read the letter aloud in the State House in Nashville last night, but now Will Hayes was furious with him. Harding couldn't fathom why. While the senators of Tennessee were voting on Friday afternoon, Harding was speaking from his front porch, advocating a new baptism in righteousness and a new consecration in morality for the nation, a return to honesty and unimpeachable virtue in civic life. His wife Florence smiled approvingly from the shadows of the porch. At the White House, Woodrow Wilson was feeling chipper, much improved, so much so that his physician, Dr. Grayson, had left his side to take a long-delayed vacation. Wilson spent his days sitting in his wheeled chair, reading in the sun of the South Portico, keeping up with the dreadful news of renewed fighting in Europe. Warsaw was under fierce attack by the Red Army, and taking long automobile rides through the Virginia countryside with Edith. He tended to public affairs for as many hours as his strength allowed, working with his secretary, Joseph Tumulty. Upon his return from his daily car excursion on Friday afternoon, Tumulty briefed him on the situation in Tennessee. Ratification in that state was halfway there, Tumulty told the president. National woman suffrage almost clinched, his League of Nations legacy possibly made secure. But there was an obstacle. The Democratic Speaker of the Tennessee House, Seth Walker, was standing in the way. Tumulty, the Suff's best friend in the White House, kept in close contact with Mrs. Catt and with Helen Hamilton Gardner, the National Association's liaison to the president. Mrs. Gardner, recently appointed by Wilson to the Civil Service Commission, was very generous to Tumulty, sending his family boxes of flowers, fresh apricots, and other delicacies. She sent such gifts to Mr. and Mrs. Wilson, too. And building on this friendly relationship, Gardner could comfortably approach Tumulty with occasional requests. On Friday evening, the president sent a telegram to Seth Walker.
May I not, in the interest of national harmony and vigor, and of the establishment of the leadership of Americans in all liberal policies, express the earnest hope that the House over which you preside will concur in the suffrage amendment?
As soon as the wire was sent, Tumulty sent a second telegram to Carrie Catt at the Hermitage, informing her of the president's message to Walker, knowing she'd be pleased. When Alice Paul learned of Wilson's gesture of help, she was also immensely pleased. Paul did not enjoy a close relationship with the White House, for understandable reasons, but she thanked the president, publicly and warmly. The message sent by President Wilson to Speaker Walker was without solicitation on our part, and we are deeply grateful for the aid he has given the suffrage cause since the fight for ratification by Tennessee began. In her glee over the combined successes of the day, the Senate ratification and the president's assistance, Paul got a bit carried away. "We have won the long fight for suffrage," she announced on Friday night. But Miss Paul was mistaken. The weekend of waiting developed into a strange interlude, marked by intensifying anxiety and hostility, move and countermaneuver. On Saturday morning, Seth Walker answered President Wilson's personal plea, and the defiant tone of Walker's telegram was remarkable, even shocking.
"I have the profound honor to acknowledge your wire of August 13th, Walker wrote to Wilson. "I do not attempt to express the views of other members of the lower house of Tennessee, but speak for myself alone, which on the Anthony Amendment are contrary to yours. You were too great to ask it, and I do not believe that men of Tennessee will surrender honest convictions for political expediency or harmony."
The arrogance of Walker's reply and its air of condescension angered many Tennessee Democrats, but made Walker an even greater hero to the Antis. He was their leader in Tennessee now, and he was showered with congratulatory messages from around the country. "I thank God that the spirit of Andrew Jackson still exists in the old volunteer state," wrote an admirer in Texas. "May your message awaken the old mountain patriots to a realization of the imperialism that threatens the rights of the states and individual liberty of the citizens." Walker also received a pat on the back from the Ox family, publishers of the Chattanooga Times. "We are with you in spirit and heartily congratulate you on the masterly manner in which you have expressed your convictions. Your courage to maintain virtue will shine resplendent in the hearts of worthy Tennesseans." At the same time, Carrie Catt found herself forced into an uncomfortable defensive crouch as she spent the weekend deflecting the Antis' vitriolic personal attacks. First, she'd had to publicly refute Senator Candler's racially loaded allegations, and on Saturday she felt obliged to push back against the newest anti-claims concerning her connection to the Woman's Bible. They'd taken out a big half-page ad in the Banner, denouncing Mrs. Stanton's tome as a suffrage tract that questioned the divinity of Christ, denigrated Christianity, and ridiculed the Christian Church. The ad even lambasted the suffragists for desecrating the Sabbath by holding convention meetings on Sundays.
This is the teaching of national suffrage leaders, the ad screamed, with Carrie Catt's name in bold type. Are you willing for women who hold these views to become political powers in our country? Catt was tired of this Bible nonsense and responded, I spoke and voted for a resolution repudiating the Bible. But it was all a red herring, she averred, a distraction from the real issue facing Tennessee, justice for women. Catt's reply was duly published in the papers, but it didn't restrain the antis from using the woman's Bible as a grenade. They invited sympathetic clergymen to view the Bible exhibit at their Hermitage headquarters, and convinced more than 24 men of the cloth to sign a petition to the legislature condemning Mrs. Stanton's heretical book and denouncing woman suffrage in general. Quite a few sermons on Sunday were devoted to demonizing the long-forgotten Bible, its long-dead author, and the beleaguered, but still living, president of the National Association, perspiring in her room at the Hermitage. Catt had reason to feel like a punching bag. Besides the anti's crude aspersions, she was being flooded with anonymous letters, dutifully delivered to her room by the bellboy. Letters that were vulgar, ignorant, insane, as she characterized them, attacking her personally and denigrating all suffragists in the most sordid manner. Catt was also convinced that her phone was being tapped at the hotel. Upton, the veteran of many a dirty Ohio campaign, told Catt that almost every day, when she opened the door to her room, she found a man just outside, leaning with his ear to the door, trying to listen to her conversations. "Pardon me," she'd bark with great annoyance, and he would scamper away. Other suffs also reported men loitering in the hallways near their rooms, trying to overhear their discussions and meetings. They took to closing the transoms above their doors, making it harder to eavesdrop, but also making their rooms unbearably hot and stuffy. Soon, Upton would find that her telegrams were being intercepted on their way from her room to the hotel's Western Union desk, and handed to anti-headquarters. The antis also felt aggrieved. Charlotte Rao announced that she was lodging a civil suit, seeking damages against Catherine Kenny for public defamation. Rao claimed that when she recently came upon Kenny talking to another suffragist in the Hermitage lobby, Kenny warned her companion, "Let us move away from that notorious woman." Rao, outraged, followed Kenny across the lobby, making quite a scene. Now the incident was the city's favorite piece of gossip. Did Kenny use the phrase notorious woman or notorious creature? While Kenny protested that she didn't say Rao was notorious in the sense of character, just reputation. Rao was not mollified. "See you in court," she told Kenny. The antis also complained that suffs were conspiring to suppress the distribution of anti-suffrage-inclined newspapers, such as the Chattanooga Times in Nashville. The paper was suddenly hard to find at the newsstand in the Hermitage lobby, or at most other vendors in town, and the antis alleged that suffs were buying bundles of the paper off the delivery truck and destroying each day's issue before it could reach the hands of readers. The Times launched an investigation. The antis were well aware that their backs were pressed against the wall, but they adopted a defiant swagger during these intervening days, boosting their image among impressionable legislators. The looming confrontation in the House was possibly the antis' last stand, their Alamo, though they were confident of a more favorable outcome than experienced by that former Tennessee legislator Davy Crockett. Along with their more aggressive stance, the antis' language and actions grew more belligerent. Friction with the suffs became physical. Upton was jostled in the Hermitage elevator by a group of Tennessee anti-women, whether Miss Pearson was among them isn't known, who made clear that she wasn't welcome in Nashville. Joe Hanover also found himself roughly shouldered in the hotel and was subjected to vile slurs as he walked through the lobby. "Kike," the Jewish legislator was called. "Bolshevist." It was getting nasty.
On one afternoon during the weekend, Cat lay down on her bed to take a nap. The heat, tension, and constant stream of visitors sapped her strength by midday, and she found 40 winks to be a tonic, keeping her going for the late-night meetings. As she stretched out on the mattress, she slipped her hand under the pillow, and her fingers hit something hard. Bolting upright, she grabbed the thing under the pillow and pulled it into the light. It was a whiskey bottle. The Antis. The Antis planted the booze, she was certain, to discredit her. It was another of their devilish plots to malign her and embarrass the cause. She didn't scream, but she did panic. She must hide it before she was caught in possession of the forbidden booze by an anti-search party, obviously the next stage of their plot. She considered hiding it in a suitcase, but that seemed too obvious. She thought of flushing it down the toilet, but the liquor smell might linger. She heard someone enter her sitting room and braced for the raid. It was only Harriet Upton walking in. "Oh, that bottle," Harriet tried to soothe the chief. There was nothing to it. A friendly woman reporter had asked if she could stow it in the suite for safekeeping. Upton had agreed, and there was nothing to be alarmed about. But Cat was still alarmed. The Suffs couldn't afford a tawdry, trumped-up scandal like this. Cat insisted that she be driven far out into the countryside, where she was finally relieved to see the whiskey bottle safely disposed, buried in the crevice of a stone wall covered with poison ivy. Paranoia had set in, but with good reason. In the wake of the Senate ratification, the Antis redoubled their efforts to swing House delegates against ratification. Whether a delegate was still noncommittal, confused, or simply ripe to have his mind changed, the Antis made a fresh push to get to him. If he remained in Nashville over the weekend, they found him. If he was at home, he was visited. There were many means of persuasion. A thriving industry of bribery and influence peddling developed, and there were rumors of sacks of money being shipped into Nashville over the weekend in advance of the House deliberations. Both the Antis and the Suffs claimed their opponents were trafficking in illicit inducements, and there were so many reports of bribes being offered and taken that a Nashville judge would soon convene a grand jury to investigate. Some legislators and politicians were said to be acting as middlemen, bringing the names of susceptible lawmakers to anti-campaigners, then arranging the payments, with a finder's fee cut for themselves. Harriet Upton learned that one Republican legislator was being offered $100 by a rogue Republican lobbyist working against ratification, on condition that the lawmaker simply go home before the House voted. The legislator decided to stay. But the delegate who'd tried to strike a bargain with Upton, "I'll vote for ratification if you can arrange for a new post office in my hometown," walked over to the Antis when she refused. Joe Hanover was swamped by reports of money being slipped under the table to influence House members' votes or to keep them from voting at all. Hanover didn't possess the usual political tools to counter these blandishments, patronage, pork, and legislative favors, such as greasing the wheels for bills sponsored by a delegate, because he was only a rank-and-file legislator with a battlefield promotion to floor leader. The Suffs also didn't have the corporate support, or cash, that the Antis seemed to possess. Hanover's most useful tool was his popularity and respect in the House. Some of the less educated legislators from the rural districts had come to rely upon Hanover to draft the bills they wanted to submit for passage, and he used his legal skills to help them. That generosity now paid off. One of those veteran members, a fiddle-playing farmer who was counted safe to vote for ratification, came to Hanover's room over the weekend to report that he'd changed his mind.
"Sorry, Joe, but I'm going to have to leave you suffrage boys," the fiddler said, a bit bleary-eyed from a long night in the Jack Daniels suite. "The Antis just paid me $200.
The way Hanover told the story, he put his arm around his colleague and said,
You sold out too cheap. I hear they're paying the others $500.
The legislator was miffed.
Well, them crooked sons of bitches, he cried. I'm gonna vote for you, Joe.
And he returned to the suffragists' camp. There were other modes of persuasion available to the antis besides cold cash. Jobs and positions could be offered, business and personal loans proffered, lucrative deals dangled. And if these didn't work, there were other techniques besides logical argument to convince a man that it was in his interest to vote against ratification. Edward Stallman, once a professional lobbyist for the railroads and still their outspoken ally, could be seen all over the Hermitage, hard at work on legislators who'd pledged to ratify, but now might be convinced to waffle and tilt. His efforts were meeting with success, and reporters were beginning to notice that in the past few days, Stallman has done more to change the minds of men who were for suffrage when they came here a week ago than any other individual. Luke Lee's Tennessean began to refer to Stallman as the Prince of Lobbyists, with grudging admiration. Enough votes are pledged to adopt the resolution in the House, a veteran State House reporter noted over the weekend, but the members do not look you in the eye when they say they will vote for it. Sentiment for ratification had cooled, and a sort of reversal of enthusiasm has been spreading over the members like wet blankets, the reporter observed. The House would like to postpone action another week or another month or another 100 years. John Houck noticed eyes averting, too. He was losing pledged men. His Senate colleagues had held firm, but lower chamber delegates were deserting the ratification ranks all through the weekend. Those smooth-talking corporation men in the Hermitage lobby were the reason, he believed. There are signs of the old railroad lobby against ratification on the surface, Houck warned RNC Chairman Will Hayes in a searing telegram. After years in the State House, Houck could spot them, the railroad men and the factory men, the steel men and the liquor men, from across the Hermitage dining room with one eye shut. He could almost smell them. In an extraordinary step, Houck went beyond his confidential note to Hayes to sound a very public alarm on Sunday evening.
I believe one of the most powerful lobbies in the history of the Tennessee legislature is now at work to defeat ratification, Houck announced to reporters. And if ratification is defeated, the special interests of the state will be responsible.
He called for a legislative inquiry into the reports of corporate influence and bribery. Sue White knew what John Houck was talking about. Her latest polling numbers kept slipping through the weekend, as men who had once pledged for ratification hesitated yet again. It was the Louisville and Nashville influence, she, like Houck, was convinced. The LNN had kept a stranglehold on the Tennessee legislature for generations, and now Edward Stallman and Seth Walker could forcefully represent the company's position against ratification in persuasive confabs with, often, intoxicated delegates. There was a powerful synergy in the workings of the anti-lobbyists. In retaliation, White threatened to reveal the names and publish the written pledges of any delegate trying to wriggle out of his promise to vote for ratification. No man would be allowed to execute a double cross quietly. Show them for the hypocrites they were, Miss Sue insisted. Blackmailers! Screamed the antis. The developments over the weekend seemed to confirm the shape of what might be called the suffragists' grand unified conspiracy theory, a political hypothesis that was far-reaching, but not so far-fetched. It tied together the LNN, Seth Walker, and Edward Stallman, and the mysterious syndicate man in the Hermitage lobby, with the money passing hands in the rooms above. It linked the refusal of the governors of Connecticut and Vermont to call special sessions with Warren Harding's infuriating ambivalence. On Sunday night, Alice Paul articulated this theory to the press. The LNN, owned by the Connecticut-based Atlantic Coastline Holding Company, was financing and directing a furious anti-ratification lobby in Tennessee, in order to protect the re-election of Connecticut Senator Frank Brandegee, who faithfully advanced the interests of the company in the U.S. Congress. With the railroads just emerging from wartime federal control, facing labor demands and capital improvement expenses, they needed to keep their friends in Congress, especially one such as Brandegee, who held a seat